Welcome to another episode of Women Leading Validation. I'm your host, Dori Gonzalez-Acevedo, co-founder and CEO of Procellarex, a life science strategic consulting firm whose mission is to rethink, reshape, and remake software quality and validation industry for the digital future. Today's podcast guest is Kimberly Wallbank. Kimberly is the managing owner and principal consultant of Quality Systems Services, LLC. With more than 25 years of industry experience, she has diverse experience and expertise in assisting pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and medical device companies achieve compliance with FDA, EMEA, and ISO, as well as other standards. Kimberly collaborates with companies to establish and maintain and improve their quality systems so they can provide a world-class healthcare product. As an industry leader, she navigates the complexities of FDA compliance while maintaining the most efficient processes for their unique business needs. She is also an adjunct professor with the College of Pharmacy at Temple University. Kimberly has a BS from Marquette University and an MBA from University of Phoenix. She currently resides and works out of New Rochelle, New York. She is passionate about ways to infuse quality roles into STEM education. Please join us for our conversation today. Hey, Kimberly, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Dori. How are you?
Good. Well, thanks for joining me on another episode of Women Leading Validation. I'm super excited to have you here today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
I am live in DC. Where are you calling in from?
I am calling in from New Rochelle, New York. So in case you're not sure where that is, I am just north of the Bronx in Westchester County.
All right. So still a nice spring day there, hopefully for you. Cool. So we got introduced via mutual friend from Connex, right?
Yes.
And I would love for you to share with the audience about who you are and like what you do in this space of quality and validation, because I think it's really interesting for our folks to hear about.
Sure. I'd be happy to. So what I do is I'm an independent consultant. I am the managing owner of Quality System Services. What I do is I help pharmaceutical and medical device companies implement, revise, recreate, or even remediate their quality systems. So there's two different venues that happen. One is the proactive way where a company says, hey, I think I have an issue, you know, with my training program, my complaint handling, my deviation system, supplier qualification. Please come help me figure this out. Or there's a new regulation they need to meet because they're expanding their business. So help me figure this out. You know, come collaborate with me to do this. The other way is the non-proactive, retroactive, where the FDA, EMEA, Health Canada has come in, has done an inspection and said, you have issues, whether it's, you know, and they get a 43, sometimes a warning letter, or heaven forbid, a consent decree. And I then come in to help them. And in some cases, the agencies will actually ask for a third party. And in those cases, I would be the third party interim control.
So you're a cleaner upper, sounds like. And whether that comes proactively or reactionary, is you clean up some messes, which potentially could help everybody out, right? And also what I'm also hearing you're saying is it's much better to be proactive in these areas rather than reactionary.
Absolutely. And for me, it's actually more fun because I'm working with people who want to collaborate, who are doing it, taking the initiative to do so. My clients who have been on the other side, they've been great too. But there's this tension of the scary FDA. Please help me get out of this. So let's take a deep breath and figure things out and make sure we're taking time to do the right thing. Sometimes can't happen on that end because the FDA's put a time limit on it.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear that. The fear factor in any transformational change is often the thing that I find that folks hold back on across the board, right? It paralyzes folks and not able to move and make decisions or thoughtful decisions like you're mentioning.
No, absolutely. And one of the things they don't think about, and you'll hear a lot of other industry people talk about this too, is the cost of quality. Mm-hmm. And so everyone thinks of it as this expense. So your, you know, other groups, non-usually QA folks, will talk about the cost of quality. This is just an added expense, added red tape. When if you think about it more of the reducing the cost of having to rework, recall, mm-hmm. Having to revise, you know, it will add up further. Right. I mean, you yeah. can go to any conference where they're talking about quality, and they'll talk about the dollars and cents of it's cheaper to fix the problem ahead of time than it is to then deal with fines.
Yep, absolutely. So Kimberly, tell us a little bit about how you even came to be doing what you're doing today. I can't imagine you dreamed as a little girl to become this quality person.
No, I did not. I did not think about in my bedroom dreaming about quality assurance. I didn't even know what that was. I was always interested in science. And even through high school, I was thinking about medical school and went away to college. And I loved the science, but the whole pre-med track was just getting a little overwhelming, a little too much stress for me. But I really did love the science. So while I was working through my undergrad, took the sciences, loved the experiments, loved the theory of it. And it was like, oh my God, what do I do for a career? Because at the time we, you know, back in the 90s, it was, if you got a biology degree like I did, you were going to medical school or you were going to graduate school to become a professor or some mm-hmm. fancy research scientist. So I ended up taking a job at Abbott Laboratories, which was the best first job I think anyone in the science field could ever have. I was in diagnostics, so it was the medical device area, where I did manufacturing, quality control, process validation. I wrote standard operating procedures. It was this jack of all trades type of get your feet wet role. But then what was also great about Abbott was I moved from there to actually working on some remediation things for their quality system. And then I did get to go into R&D because at the time it was like, this is kind of what I want to do, but I wasn't ready for grad school. Loved it. But I just didn't see the graduate program path for me at the time. So I ended up leaving Abbott and going to Wyeth, where I, again, worked in compliance and worked my way up to quality and got an MBA along the way, because one of the things I figured I was missing was those soft business skills. So I had these hardcore science skills, but I was having some difficulties with managing projects, with working through timelines, setting up timelines, you know, things that you would think about if you had a business degree. So one of my favorite jobs was working as the quality assurance manager for lab validations. I had a great team. We did everything from proving validation and maintenance documents for everything in the laboratories, from, you know, balances all the way to the HVAC system to the computer systems. So it was very much an integrated approach we took and a very collaborative approach, not only within our team, but also with the laboratories.
But also hands-on too.
Yes. Yes. Very mm-hmm. hands-on. And I put my MBA to skills in that job because unlike the other managers, I didn't have one customer. I had five. Mm-hmm. You know, I had five different directors I had to support. So I had to come up with things like special scheduling meetings, where I would have all these directors show up so they could understand of, you know, if micro has a priority and chemistry is a priority and biochemistry is a priority, we need to figure out from a business perspective, which is the priority, because again, I only had so many reviewers and approvers to do the work. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was very interesting, very exciting. One of the favorite things I did in that was develop my team. In fact, I occasionally follow them on LinkedIn and seeing where they are. I mean, one's, I believe, now a vice president. Another one is, she was a temp for me. I had some, was fortunately able to bring some temps on, and she was absolutely incredible. In fact, I actually got her hired to a different department, and they said, and they actually asked me, like, why are you getting rid of her? I said, I'm not trying to get rid of her. It's just her skills fit you better, and that's what she wants, not what I, you know, I mean, yeah, I could still use her, but I was thinking about her future. And now I think she owns her own company, if I remember correctly. I haven't followed her in about a few months, but yeah, she's inventing things and running her own company now, which is fantastic.
That's very cool. So a couple of things I hear in what you're saying I'm interested in to learn more about is, what do you think are some of those skills that you need in order to do quality and compliance in this new, you know, in the way that you're talking about, you know, proactive, hands-on, really, you know, and elevating the output, right? It sounds like you built a team previously, right, to do some of that. What are some of the skills that you think that are critical for that?
There's a lot of soft skills. One of the things I find that listening, active listening, is very important. One of the things I do with my clients is I use them to get information about their company and their systems before I even start suggesting changes. Some of them get a little frustrated at first. They're like, I just need you to fix it. And it's like,
so that's interesting. I experienced that same thing. So like having that slow conversation is super important in order to get to the next stage, but folks are hesitant on that. What do you think that's about?
Well, a lot of times it's, they just want it done. They just want it done, and they see you as a cost, which I am. But I like to think of my services as more of an investment for them as opposed to an expense. And as someone who has dealt with consultants coming in and fixing problems, you want that consultant to ask the questions first. I've seen consultants come in back way back when, just sit in a corner and just write SOPs. And next thing you know, you're being forced to follow them, and they are so convoluted. In order to follow them, you need to double the size of your team. It's adding to your timeline, adding to the cost of the product. And we all know how much medications cost nowadays. So you're just adding to that cost. So I found that if I did not want to be that kind of consultant. So I wanted to understand your current process, your current organization, so I can help you put the right fixes in. In fact, a lot of times I ask to do a gap assessment first, just to kind of see where the weaknesses are, the holes are. Because some people, you know, I get cold calls saying, I'm a CMO and I sell products to people who are using our products for phase three, but they're going to commercial and now they're asking me for all this information. So I think I need to have additional ISO requirements, opposed to ISO 9000. And it's like, well, yeah, you probably need 1345 for medical device. That's fine. But, and they're like, okay, so just write procedures for me. How much is that going to cost?
Right.
And it's like, well, hold on. There are elements of 9000 that are in 1345.
Right. You don't have to do the whole thing over.
For a extra fee, let's figure out what those holes are. Because it could be based on your procedures. And again, at this point, I haven't even seen the procedures they had.
Right.
It may be some minor tweaks. You don't need brand new SOPs. You know, or you may need one new SOP because you weren't thinking about incoming quality, for example.
Right. Or you might need to slash your existing stuff because it didn't make operational efficiencies. Yeah, I think that there's, I think you and I are very similar in mindset in trying to educate and elevate the conversation as quickly as possible rather than waiting for the downstream unintended consequences of putting poor procedures in place or not well thought out procedures, not necessarily poor procedure, but not well thought out, not holistic, not integrated or understanding the connections between business lines and roles and responsibilities and who's doing what and all of those sorts of things, which add cost for a variety of things, not just the SOPs that are written and the external resources potentially to write those, but it's following those, it's training for those, it's then the uptake of maintaining that poor or misguided process along the ways, potentially with also tools to perpetuate those bad processes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things I try to share with these clients, these potential clients, is that this is your system. Whatever I help you fix, you own. You're the one who's going to have to defend it in an inspection or an audit.
And let's be clear about that, because when you're talking about system, you're talking about their quality management system,
yes,
which is a combination of not only their policies and procedures, but then the extension of which the people that do that thing and then the applications that support that and all of that. So it's much, much bigger, much, much broader, and typically is used across the entire organization.
Absolutely. And actually, I just recently got a mentor for myself to help me, because obviously I admit I don't know everything. And so I've been working with her on, not only just how to grow my business, but how to convey what I do, because I am absolutely terrible at saying, look at me, I can do this. And so I started writing a blog, which first came out this month. And what you just touched on about the whole process and how, it's just bigger than just the SOPs and quality. My blog piece was on a sweater I just finished knitting. So I knit as a hobby. It's one of my favorite things to do. The aspects of helping you quiet your mind, helping, ease stress is all true. But this particular sweater I just finished was my first sweater where I had to sew in actual sleeves. And I go through in the blog piece, which is on my website, of how frustrating it was trying to figure out how to do it. Mm. And then finding the right expert to help me. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten some pretty interesting comments about it. So like, first of all, they all found it funny. And two, it just talks about how things are linked together. Like I could have just left the sleeves off, but then I would have had some weird looking poncho that was very expensive.
Yes, you could have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the interconnectedness of all of us is really super important. And one of the things that I've, as this industry has shifted and as the relationships between contractors, consultants, vendors, companies and sponsors, those lines are changing, right? And whose role and what responsibility each others are helping to fulfill has shifted, right? From when you and I both started, right, to where we are today. And it's continuing to change as it's gotten more complex, right? Like there's just more asks. The products that our sponsors are making are more complex. They're more integrated with different parts of different SMEs, right? So you might have those, software embedded as a medical device where you have software and a medical device and maybe potentially even having a drug in there as well, right? And so there's not one single source of ownership. It's a collaborative network that creates these products that we have today. And so that takes a more complicated system or team in order to get to an operational quality managed operation. And then so think about how many different parts of the supply chain are all connected. All those different quality systems are connected and impact one another. And there needs to be very clear understanding between all of those parties of who's doing what.
No, absolutely. And because I have been working with some clients lately who are working on combination products, and they're doing the right thing of hiring, if they're a drug company, they're hiring some medical device folks. If they're medical device folks, they're hiring the drug folks. If it's a drug medical device combination product, the key that they're having some difficulties with is integrating those two teams together. They tend to put up this firewall between them and try to almost imaginarily split the product. Mm-hmm. And it's like, but you need to work together because the product works itself together.
Right.
But the other thing that's happening a lot more recently is virtual companies. And that's something that I've been working with as well. And that creates a whole different dynamic of a quality system. Because there's a lot more supplier qualifications involved. And it also creates some interesting avenues when it comes to items like investigations and complaint handling. I've had some clients where complaint handling seems to be one of the, tends to be my bread and butter lately. Particularly since these phase three custom clients, it seems to be the one of, oh yeah, now we need to beef up complaint handling because we're about to really sell. They've had it because of clinicals, but
but loosely, yeah.
Right. So one of the key things is what I call reverse logistics. How do you get the product back? And when you are a virtual company where there is no real office, where does it go? And it becomes even more interesting when your drug substance is being made at company A, drug products being made at company B, packaging and labeling's happening at company C, and all testing's happening at company D. Okay, so where are you sending this?
Right. Great question.
So I get these interesting logic problems, and I truly enjoy solving logic problems. I think that's... Yeah.
And there's no one right answer either, right? And so it's a matter of interpretation and business objectives and how are you going to handle it and solving that puzzle, right? And then putting in structure to support that on an ongoing basis, right?
And it goes back to your other point about the organization working together. Because quality tends to have to figure that out. But in this particular example I just provided, supply chain needs to be involved. They're the ones who have those relationships with those companies. So they need to have an also somewhat of a quality mindset and work together with quality to help solve those types of issues.
Yeah, it's a great... supply chain is just so complicated these days than it was years ago. And I think globally we've shown that we were able to handle it, albeit the COVID vaccine program, right? We were able to handle it in a way that no one thought was, would have never thought possible before, right? And it was solvable and it sustained it. Some can argue it wasn't fast enough, but frankly, the things that the industry did in such a short period of time in order to get drug product where it needed to go was pretty remarkable. I'd be interested to see future, you know, kind of look back and an analysis of that from a timing perspective. But I really wish we could really double down on some of those lessons that we've learned through that process, the risks that we've taken that were calculated risks in that time and space, and how to capitalize on that moving forward, right? Like how to do that on a routine basis rather than make it an urgent crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, risk is always something that, you know, these companies have to deal with. I mean, risk became the word back in the late 90s. From the FDA and managing the risk and documenting the risk. And that's another, I actually finished doing a talk a few weeks ago on risk-based decisions in complaint systems. And the key takeaway I was trying to say was that, again, your organization needs to work together. QA can't just make the decision. Sometimes you need your medical affairs team involved to help make the decision because you're talking about someone's life. And, but you also have to have supply chain involved and manufacturing involved. And documenting those decisions and documenting your rationale of why this risk is okay. And if the risk is pretty high, what are you going to do to mitigate it?
Yep. Yeah. So given all of that you do today and where you came from, would have there been any things that you would do differently or how, you know, if you were to talk to your younger self, you know, if I did this, this, and this, I can do it a little bit differently these days?
Oh, yes. I think I have that conversation with myself pretty much on a daily basis. the key one is to seek out mentors a little earlier in life. I was a little shy and a little nervous and felt just I needed just to do what the senior people in my team told me to do, which again helps, they have knowledge, but to also engage them in why are we doing it this way? What was your path to get to where you are? You know, and ask those types of questions. I wish I had done that a little earlier. The other thing is to not take everything a little as seriously as I did. I came out very much, you know, lab coat ready and just tunnel focused as opposed to trying to think the broad picture.
I think that was very characteristic of the day and the age in which we were in college and what we were conditioned to do. You know, when I interview younger folk today coming out, they are all open for open-ended questions. And right, like, that is not the conditioning of, you know, as a chemist and a biochemist at, by education, that is not the how I was conditioned in undergrad and graduate school.
Oh, no. In fact, the reason why I was terrible at R&D was I was so afraid to fail. I was conditioned, you know, as you probably were, that you needed to get it right the first time. And so, but that's not how experiments work.
Right.
But it's one of those things where being afraid to fail and learn from it, you know, it was this, oh, you failed, so you can't do it again. That was the message we always got. So I think that's one of the reasons why like R&D just did not end up working for me. Whereas quality was like, you have to get it right. You have to find ways to make sure you get it right the first time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because so as I was a chemical process, an R&D chemist. And so in some ways, but I was put right into generics. That's where I started. And in generics, there's no room for, I mean, you can experiment, but there's really no room and margin for error because everything is commoditized, right? So while that is a very different look and feel from an R&D perspective versus the big blockbuster ones where you have years to experiment, right? Albeit those years cost a lot more money, and we see that how long a new blockbuster takes to go to market and the expense of that. But in the generic market, I think for me, it was conditioned very, very early on that every experiment matters. So every tweaking really matters, and you learn from every lesson all along the way. And that coupled very nicely with a quality management system that evolved for those for that business process, right? Because it was so interconnected because every penny mattered, every ounce of waste mattered. Because we didn't have those margins, right? And I think that that is also interesting in relationship to where the industry is going, because no one wants to continue to have this burden of these exorbitant costs in that. And so we need to be smarter in all areas, right? And where to experiment and where to get it right the first time as quickly as possible in order to reduce that cost.
Yeah, I remember my first day, I worked in R&D. I was working on first in class of a diagnostic tool. We were taking something that was a big standalone piece of equipment in a lab, in a hospital, and trying to find a way to shrink it down to where you can put in an ambulance. So I was working on the assays.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was very exciting. And I remember my first experiment that I had experiments before this go well to where we learned things from it. Like, okay, this is not the right configuration. But I had one experiment just go sideways on me, completely go sideways on me. And I'm presenting it to the team and I'm the only woman in the room. And actually in my team, you know, they were great. I was the only person under 30. I was the only person without a PhD. But they treated me like an equal. And this was the one time I really realized they were doing it, because I just went, yep, yeah, I failed. It's all my fault. And they're like, the instrument died on you. Like, that's not your fault that the instrument. I said, well, I should have double, triple checked it. They go, oh, I didn't realize you had superpowers to make the equipment do what it's supposed to do.
Yes, you are superpowers. That's funny. So let's fast forward to what you're doing today. Tell me about your company. What are you guys are doing? How are you servicing and helping your customers?
So what I'm doing a lot more of is trying to focus on startups. There's a lot of these biotech, you know, med device startups coming out with some really fascinating products that are coming to market. So I'm trying to focus on them in helping them find their quality system. And starting off with the whole process of baby steps, you know, this is the bare minimum you need for today because you're at phase two, phase three clinicals. Okay. Now you're heading to commercial. So this is the next where you need to be, so that you're doing these incremental changes as opposed to a massive quality system overload dump. And then I'm doing some little side projects with Marquette University, my alma mater, and doing some other things with some other organizations. Marquette has always been very close to my heart. I graduated 20 something years ago. One of the things I went back and I've been talking to Dean Bostic about quite a bit is the biology department. They now call it biological sciences. And helping those students understand that there's many different avenues in their career they could take. You don't need that tunnel of you're either going to medical school or you're going to become a professor. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think much about it until the pandemic hit, and I was trying to get involved from, you know, 1,000 miles away, and I did a talk with their entrepreneurial group. And one of the professors from that department was on and said, you know, your talk was very interesting. I didn't realize this was a path someone could take with our degree. I get a lot of my students coming to me going, what do I do next? And his answer was, oh. And that kind of broke my heart. It was like, it's been like almost 25 years and students are still feeling this way. So I've been doing some mentoring with some of the Marquette students, and then Dr. Bostic once a year does these seminars with alumni from the arts and sciences of where your career went. How did you go from getting a degree at Marquette and going into, you know, your industry, and what tools did you take with you from your degree? And during my talk this past fall, I actually had a student get on and said, you know, this has been so helpful. She goes, I actually was thinking about leaving the department and going going into English because I didn't know what to do with it. And at least English, it was something else. And I did everything I could not to cry on the call. Mm-hmm. In fact, I even told everybody, contact me if you have any other questions. And I reached out to the dean after, said, please make sure this student has my information. She's more than willing to contact me anytime. So That's been kind of one of my joys, is kind of helping them out.
What you're doing is wonderful. And I think that there's many examples of that, that making these connections in practical ways to help colleges and even in high school. Because I mean, you know, I met recently, actually at the last Connects conference, someone that didn't go to college and is now a QA manager. And, you know, he didn't have any experience and just didn't know, and he fell into it and worked his way up. And right from high school, he just knew that he was different and wanted to do something different. And I think that there's a lot of different ways that this industry can provide good jobs for folks. It's just not well articulated. You have to have a certain pedigree or a degree and all that sort of stuff. And that's not necessarily the case at all.
In fact, the person who trained me fresh out of college at Abbott had a GED. He had been working at Abbott for over 20 years. He worked his way up from, I think, warehouse or cleaning glassware all the way to the team I was on. And between him and the PhDs were great on the team. But if I had a question, he was the guy I went to first. And it wasn't that the PhDs didn't know what they were talking about, because they were very brilliant. It was not only could he knew it, he also could explain it and made it easy to understand. So it's one of those things. In fact, one of the things I've been trying to participate in more are these women in STEM talks, you know, for high school and college. And a lot of times I get the pushback of, well, you're not a scientist, you're not an engineer. I'm like, I have the degree. I am in an industry where science and engineering is needed and encouraged. Let's show these children or these young people what other fields they can go into besides, you know, STEM just isn't, you know, going to the moon or saving the whales. I mean, those things are very exciting and very important, but there's other things you can do in STEM. And I think not having people like myself or you or other people in quality participate in them is definitely a disadvantage to these young people coming out.
I 100% applaud you and 1000% agree with you. It's the diversity of thought at all levels of organizations, regardless, when we're talking right now about life sciences and particular industry, but it exists everywhere, right? And to get away from that hierarchical kind of way of thinking and to get actionable, meaningful dialogue to occur needs to have some diversity of thought.
Yeah. And some of these requirements to work up your way to management needs to be really thought through because
now you're touching on some really hot topics here.
Like micro, for some reason, most companies are requiring the director to be a PhD. Okay. Well, so you're telling me that someone who has a bachelor's in micro, who's been working years in the laboratory, who has kept up with their training, who has kept up with the academia, the papers, and everything else, isn't as qualified as someone who has a PhD? And because me, I think they may actually be more qualified, particularly if they have more personable skills to actually manage the team. And that's the thing that happens quite a bit is that they focus on the technical skills needed to be the manager and not the managerial leadership skills that need to be the manager.
Yes. Which I had a dinner last night with a colleague and PhD postdoc in academia. And I asked him, so how often do you actually do science anymore? And he's like, you know, at the end of the day, all of those other skills you just mentioned are so much more critical to then the thing or the widget that we're making or the thing that we're testing. And while all that's important, we can pull from other people that information in order to get it done, right? But if you don't have those other rounded facets, we can't get to the next step.
Yeah, I had a manager once who, great guy, but I had to go beg for feedback. So I go, so how am I doing? Like, I haven't heard anything, because usually from other managers, you know, once a week, once a month, you were the one-on-ones, and sometimes they were great. Sometimes they were like, you know, the big, like, oh, it seems like you're just getting picked on with every little thing you did wrong for the week. I never would hear, I mean, he'd talk at meetings and we would discuss experiments and everything else. I'm like, so how am I doing? And he goes, doing what? You're doing your experiments. So, and I'm like, but am I meeting expectations of what you want me to do? They go, you're doing your experiments, right? Yes. Okay. Well, just keep doing that. Okay. I mean, like,
want you to be that robot.
Yeah. He goes, that's just HR stuff. And it was like, but how can I get better if I don't know what I need to work on or how am I doing, you know? And it was just kind of like, well, you're getting experiments done, so everything's fine.
So tell me, so how did you like transitioning being a consultant, separate, running your own business, all that sort of stuff? How do you like that?
I do. I really like it. I find it quite liberating. I mean, there's some things that, you know, I mean, everything has its pros and cons. I mean, I work at the behest of my clients. So while there are lulls in my schedule, which are great, sometimes they're not exactly when I would like them to be. But it is great not to have to worry about certain politics in a company. I do have to deal with the politics of my client. However, I do know that that is temporary as opposed to being focused on me. And just being able to have that freedom to say, you know what, this is the right client for me to work with because I know I can help them. Or, you know what, I think you need someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, so the clients who come to me going, just give me your SOP package. I'm like, that is not me. I do not have a standard set of SOPs that I just write and then just hand them out. Because it's not going to work for everybody. And it's probably not going to work for most people because I sat at my own kitchen counter and wrote them and they didn't take into effect of where your organization works.
Yeah. Folks don't like that answer. No. I say the same thing. They don't like that answer. More often than not, I get a request for a proposal for something and they just want to know, well, what do you always do? And it's very, very hard to have that conversation enough to be able to slow them down to say, it depends.
Yeah.
Right. It depends on a couple of different things. And can we have a conversation about that? And when their procurement process is all about just getting numbers, it's not necessarily numbers that make meaning if we're not able to have those additional conversations, right? Because it's right sizing the whatever it is for the right reasons, right? It gets back to, I think, in the beginning when you said knowing your why, right? And this is a theme that I think comes up often on these podcasts that I've been talking about specifically with the Women Leading Validation folks that I've been interviewing is we are much more interested in understanding the why. I don't know. Is that gender specific? Not sure, but it's a very, very, it comes up in almost every conversation I have with the women that I've been interviewing for Women Leading Validation is what, why are we doing this or what is important or the disguised how come is it a similar question? Is still a why question? No,
I think the reason it, I mean, I've heard men ask it, but I think women ask it more. And I think it has to do with the fact we are always so overburdened with action items. So we've been, in at least in the last 10 to 20 years, have been focused on, okay, why do I have to do this? You know, why this? So, because obviously most of us are trying to get things off our plate because, you know, some people have husbands and children and dealing with household and caregiving of older parents. So we bring some of that thought process to work of why do I need to do this? Because this is just one more thing to do. So when you understand the why, you're more apt to do it. but also it might be, well, that might not be the right approach. There's a better, more effective, more efficient way to address that particular need. And I think also it's not just women. I think it's this younger generation coming up behind us who are asking a lot of the whys of why are we doing this? You know, back to the whole open question thing, you know, why are we doing this? Like, cause this just seems old and antiquated. Why are we doing this? So I think they're also kind of pushing us to ask those questions.
Yeah, I do. I feel that a lot. It energizes me because I feel validated. I'm like, thank God someone else is asking these questions, not me anymore. So what's next for you?
Well, I am starting to do some writing, some work-related and non-work-related. I'm working on two articles right now, around complaint handling. I'm trying to get out of the pigeonhole of complaint handling. However, it's not going away anytime soon.
It's hard to get out of that. Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, other clients will look at me, you know, or talk to me like, well, other consulting firms who need to bring on additional consultants. And they're like, well, we're working with this company on batch records, so I can do batch records. They go, yeah, but I'm seeing like the last five clients you had were on complaint handling. I go, well, if you look at what the FDA has been picking on lately, it's been complaint handling. So if they were picking on batch records, I would have been doing batch records. So, but one of the things I've learned from my clients, because I feel not only do they learn from you, you learn from them, is the key piece of complaint handling that is causing the most headache is the intake triage piece, the piece that happens before the investigation. How do you get the information from the patient and the user? How do you get the product back? So because obviously, like anything else, design control, research, it's garbage in, garbage out. So if you're not doing the first piece right, you can do the best investigation you want, but you didn't solve your problem.
Right.
So I've been focusing on doing some writing on those key pieces. And then I am actually tackling some short stories.
Cool.
I've been thinking about this since the shutdown, and I've have some ideas in my head. I have these little pieces here or there. So we're going to see where it goes, because one of the things I've learned from the shutdown, the pandemic, and from this generation coming up from, you know, behind is why just do one thing? You know, there's other things to try and do something else. And it's weird to do writing because English, I did well in English, but not as well in this as I did in science and math, to where teachers tend to was like, just pass English, just, you know, and
I'm there with you. Yeah.
So the fact that I'm wanting to write is great. I think science has helped me do that because I like the technical writing piece. So it's this creative piece has kind of given me a different outlet to kind of figure some things out as well. And then continuing some of this work and trying to push the fact that quality is part of STEM.
Yeah. I like that. I have some connections maybe and we need to hook you up with around that initiative. I think it's an important topic as well as in education. And so make sure we'll connect about that outside of here, because I think that's really important.
Yeah, I would love that, because I keep going. I look, you know, and that's the whole, you know, me trying to market myself, market my company, is I'm trying to say, I can help you. Please talk to me. This is why you should come talk to me. I have some knowledge, and it's been difficult for me because I went to Catholic school, younger years, and you didn't do the look at me. It was, you sat in the corner, you did your hard work. If you did it well enough and all by yourself, you got credit. That's not how the world works.
Yeah. So that is true. And, as a chief member and a lot of the learnings here last year with my journey in chief is really to start taking that on individually, right? Like it is actively saying what I'm good at, publicly, right? Like that's hard.
for a variety of reasons, right? For us to actually showcase what we do well as women. And for whatever variety of reasons, comes naturally to many men. It does not necessarily come naturally to women. And how we have to really buck our own insecurities in order to have that more regularly happen. And so I'm here to support you in that, in your journey. It's hard to do, and just keep doing it as you just continue to evolve. Right.
You know, one of the books I love to read, and I'm going to blank on the authors, I apologize, but The Confidence Code. It was written several years ago. And one of the things that came out was math problems, and how they asked, you know, men and women, you know, you're going to do some math problems. And they did math problems. And they, before they graded them, they said, how well did you do? And the women went, I did okay. You know, but the men were like, oh, I did great. But they got the same score. You know, mm-hmm. So it was interesting of how, like, the men were like, yes, I'm confident I got it right. And sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. But the women were like, yeah, I'm not sure, because we're looking for that validation. We want someone else to tell us we did it right. And that's one of the things I've learned as a consultant of, no, I know what I'm doing. And I need to say that more often. I need to share that, but find that communication way to where it's coming off as confident in an expert, as opposed to coming from an arrogance, you know? So yep. That's where, because to me, it's very binary. It's either you don't tell people or you're arrogant. So I'm trying to find that happy medium and what that looks like.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we will be sure to link all your contact information in the show notes when this gets published, to make sure people know how to find you, connect with you on LinkedIn, and reach out so that you can help them in their journeys and where they're at with their organization and how you can help them. Does that sound good?
That's wonderful, Dori. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kimberly. It has been a pleasure to chat with you, and hopefully soon at a Connects Congress, we actually get to meet in person. That would be awesome.
Yes, thank you. I look forward to that too.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks, Dori. You too.